The fantasy of a hostile foreign nation launching a full-scale invasion of the United States has been a common trope in fiction now for decades. And while the idea of a foreign power invading the United States has been around since the nation's founding, the modern fictional trend of depicting a foreign invasion of the country sort of dates back to the release of the movie Red Dawn in 1984, which depicts a joint Soviet, Cuban, Nicaraguan, and Mexican ground invasion of the United States over the Mexican border after Mexico undergoes a communist revolution that installs a Marxist government in power there that grants the Soviets military access. While its remake that came out decades later in 2012 somewhat more implausibly depicts a joint North Korean-Russian invasion and occupation of the U.S. West Coast instead. The idea has also been a fairly common trope in recent video games, with Call of Duty's Modern Warfare 2 released in 2009 and its sequel Modern Warfare 3, that released in 2011, both depicting a massive Russian invasion and occupation of the entire US East Coast. A feat that stretched the imagination even back then, a decade before Russia's struggling invasion of Ukraine began. There's also the video game Homefront that released in 2011, that depicts a successful North Korean invasion and occupation of the Western US. And then there's also the many Fallout games that in the build-up to global nuclear war depicts a full-scale Chinese invasion of Alaska from across the Bering Strait. But obviously, as interesting as all of these fictional scenarios are, we all know deep down that the United States could never actually become the target of a hostile foreign invasion. We all know that the United States is separated from any major rival by two vast oceans. And we all know that the US military is dramatically more powerful than any rival is. We've all been watching how terrible the Russian invasion of Ukraine has been going for the past 2+ years now. And that's a country that's directly next door to Russia that has thousands of kilometers worth of land borders. Let alone what an invasion of a much bigger country over on the other side of the world would look like. We all generally know that a big foreign invasion of the United States is impossible. But what most of us don't really appreciate is just how utterly, laughably impossible it actually is when you really start digging into the specifics of it. And I will argue in this video that even if the entire rest of the outside world combined joined all of their populations and military assets to cooperate on a mission to invade and conquer the United States, it would still be completely impossible for them to all actually pull it off. And here are all of the many, many reasons why that's the case. First of all, any attempted invasion of the United States would have to immediately encounter the American nuclear defense strategy and doctrine, which, all on its own, would immediately halt any invasion attempt from the outside world. You see, the United States utilizes a nuclear triad defense doctrine, a three-legged strategy that involves land-based, sea-based, and air-based nuclear weapons scattered all across the world that would be logistically impossible for anyone, no matter how strong, to fully eliminate before the United States could retaliate. The land-based leg of America's nuclear triad is represented by the hundreds of hardened nuclear ICBM launch silos that the country operates and maintains across the Great Plains in the states of Montana, North Dakota, Wyoming, Nebraska, and Colorado, deep within the interior of the country, thousands of miles away from any beachhead landing site that an invading army could potentially attack from. There are around 450 total ICBM silo locations scattered all across all of these territories, but only around 400 of the silos actually contain the missiles, leaving around 50 of them behind as decoys to disrupt any potential first strike on them and waste an attacker's time. Under normal circumstances, the US President and the Secretary of Defense have direct, reliable, and almost instant contact with each of the ICBM launch crews. The launch control facilities for each of these missile silos are located at the three different military bases nearby to each of the silo clusters. If, when under attack, contact between these ground-based launch control centers and the remote missile launch facilities is lost, specially designed E-6B airborne launch control center aircraft will automatically assume the command and control of the missiles from the air, from within the interior of the country that will maintain direct contact with the president. Which means that even if an enemy was somehow able to neutralize all three military bases and their command centers at once in the middle of Montana, North Dakota, and Wyoming, they would still have to contend with somehow shooting down all of these planes as well. Were an invading enemy to fail, each of the hundreds of ICBMs that America parks underground across these hundreds of silos pack enough destructive force to blow up an entire city, and they have an operating range of approximately 14,000 kilometers, enabling them to strike virtually all major population centers across the Americas, Eurasia, Oceania, and most of Northern Africa if they wanted to, leaving only Southern Africa and Western Australia outside of America's ICBM range. And even if you were somehow able to avoid or neutralize all of these hundreds of land-based ICBMs, you'd still have to deal with a sea-based leg of America's nuclear triad as well. The United States maintains a fleet of 14 Ohio-class strategic submarines that can be armed with submarine-launched ballistic missiles carrying nuclear warheads. 8 of these nuclear-armed strategic missile submarines are homeported in Bangor, Washington, nearby to Seattle, while the other 6 are homeported in Kings Bay, Georgia, nearby to Jacksonville, providing the U.S. strategic submarine fleet with major bases of operations in both the Pacific and the Atlantic. Each of these strategic submarines are powered by an advanced nuclear reactor on board, which enables the subs to operate effectively indefinitely without the need to ever refuel. This is how, on average, each of the subs will spend about 77 days continually at sea and underwater out on patrol, followed by around 35 days back at port in either Georgia or Washington for maintenance before going back out on patrol again. Because of this rotating cycle of patrol and maintenance, the U.S. Navy maintains around 8 of these strategic missile submarines scattered all around the world's oceans at any given time, 365 days a year. Their exact locations while out on patrol beneath the ocean at any given time is a closely guarded top secret, which is the whole point of them. They could be anywhere at any time, and a major attack on the United States would have to consider that. Each of these 8 or so strategic submarines that are constantly out on patrol are armed with around 20 Trident II D5 ballistic missiles that contain multiple independently targeted nuclear warheads on board. The missiles' exact range is classified, but it's estimated to be somewhere around 12,000 kilometers or more, and they're so accurate, they can hit their intended targets within only 100 meters from all that distance away. Each one of these strategic missile submarines packs enough apocalyptic firepower to destroy an entire country, and there are always 8 of them permanently deployed around the world at all times in unknown locations that any attacker of the United States would also somehow have to deal with. You'd have to somehow find and eliminate all 8 of these nuclear submarines that could be located literally anywhere across any of Earth's oceans before they could fire their missiles, which would sort of be like trying to find 8 needles across 3 haystacks, each the size of a city. And if the sea and land-based legs of America's nuclear triad weren't enough, there's also the air-based leg of the triad that any attacker would have to contend with as well. The U.S. military stores hundreds of nuclear bombs across several of their overseas military bases abroad, including across 6 of their bases in Europe, ranging from Kleinobrogel in Belgium, to Volkel in the Netherlands, Buchel in Germany, Gedi and Aviano both in Italy, and at Incirlik in Turkey. U.S. strategic bombers stationed at these European bases can be quickly armed with nuclear bombs and given orders to take off for strategic strikes. While almost certainly, the United States also stores nuclear bombs at another one of their overseas military bases on a small island here called Diego Garcia, in the middle of the Indian Ocean, where American strategic bombers can sortie out from and attack targets rapidly anywhere around the rim of the Indian Ocean, putting locations like Western Australia and Southern Africa that are out of range of American ICBMs to being within range of American strategic bombers. Combined, the land, sea, and air-based legs of America's nuclear triad put the entire world into the range of American nuclear firepower, which means that in order for an enemy to avoid an overwhelming U.S. nuclear response, an invader would have to somehow eliminate every single component of the entire triad. From all of the hundreds of missile silos in their command centers across the interior of the country, deep within North America, to all 8 of the submarines operating at secret locations across the world's oceans and their bases on opposite ends of the country, to all of the nuclear bomb storage sites and their air bases dotted all across Europe and on the other side of the world in the dead center of the Indian Ocean. Dismantling all of this would require worldwide logistical coordination and support to have any hope of success already, and it's probably just an impossible feat to accomplish on its own. And in addition to America's advanced offensive capabilities with firing their nukes at enemies, there's also America's advanced defensive capabilities with intercepting and destroying incoming enemy nuclear attacks as well. You see, there are only 7 countries in the entire world outside of the United States that are known to possess nuclear-armed ICBMs in their arsenals. The United Kingdom, France, Russia, Israel, India, China, and North Korea. And the only states out of that narrow list that are actually potentially hostile to the United States are Russia, China, and North Korea. But even if every single ICBM-armed country was hostile to the United States, they would all still have a difficult time with getting all of their missiles through into the United States without inviting a U.S. retaliatory strike that would destroy them all as well. Every nuclear ICBM-armed power is located within the Northern Hemisphere, and all of them besides for the United States are also located in the Eastern Hemisphere, which means that if any of them were to fire their missiles at the United States, the shortest distance for them to take would be by flying over the Arctic Circle and Canada first. The US, of course, has been well aware of this dynamic for decades now, which is why the country maintains an advanced early missile warning system called the Solid State Phased Array Radar System, or SSPAR. The whole network maintains systems bases at 5 geographically separate locations that roughly covers the entire continental United States by early warning radar and space surveillance, with bases within or near to the Arctic Circle in the UK, northwestern Greenland, and central Alaska, and additional bases for Pacific and Atlantic coverage based at Beale, California, and at Cape Cod, Massachusetts, all of which work together to alert the United States of any potential ICBM approaches hours before they actually strike, giving Washington plenty of time to plan out a retaliatory strike. But okay, let's just assume that for whatever reason, nuclear weapons aren't being used in an invasion of the United States, and America's nuclear arsenal has been either successfully destroyed or it's been decided to not use it. A massive ground invasion of the US mainland, even if carried out by the entire outside world combined, still wouldn't work out for the following reasons. First of all, is America's vast and interconnected defense alliance network with dozens of other countries from all around the globe. As of 2024, the United States maintains legally binding mutual defense pacts with 53 different countries from all around the world, spanning all the countries in NATO, including big countries like Canada, Spain, the UK, France, Germany, Italy, Poland, Sweden, and Turkey, the Rio Treaty in the Americas that includes big countries like Brazil, Colombia, and Argentina, the ANZUS Treaty with Australia and New Zealand, and more individual defense treaties that have been crafted with Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, and Thailand. Out of the top 40 countries in the world by annual military spending after the United States, 23 of them are legally obliged to come to America's defense during an attack or invasion scenario. And that's on top of the estimated 750 or so U.S. military bases that are dotted all across the world that harshly contain any potential American geopolitical rival. Russia is surrounded by NATO countries in the west and by Japan and South Korea in the east. China and North Korea, meanwhile, are heavily contained by American military bases in the region and by America's regional allies in the First Island Chain, Japan, South Korea, and the Philippines, and to a lesser degree by Taiwan and Thailand, while Iran is similarly constrained by American military bases to their south and west. In order for anyone to carry out a successful invasion of the United States, hundreds of these overseas U.S. military bases with tens of thousands of U.S. troops at them would all have to somehow be neutralized first, while America's massive defensive alliance system that spans around the world would also have to somehow be dissolved or neutralized too, just in order to prevent most of the other most powerful countries in the world from assisting the U.S. And then, even if an outside power was able to somehow do all of that and unite the entire world against America, they would still have to contend with the sheer power of the US armed forces themselves, which, all on their own, even without any allies, are virtually unchallengeable. And that's because the US Air Force, and especially the US Navy, are truly in a league of their own on a global scale. In terms of naval assets, other than France, the United States is the only country in the world that operates nuclear-powered aircraft carriers. And while France only has one of these nuclear-powered carriers, the United States currently has 11 of them. There are 27 aircraft carriers currently in service worldwide across every country's navy. And all of them outside of the American and French navies are powered with traditional diesel or gasoline fuel. This enables America's carriers to hypothetically run continually without the need to refuel themselves for up to 25 years. With the need to find a port to refuel for oil eliminated, the only limiting factors for a U.S. carrier deployment are shore leave and food stores. And food stores can be provided by helicopters to the carrier if they really don't want to stop at a port and extend their mission length. 40% of all the operating aircraft carriers in the world right now are within the U.S. Navy alone, while 77% of all the world's aircraft carriers belong to the US and America's treaty allies in NATO, plus Japan and Thailand. And none of the other carriers besides that single one controlled by France can match American nuclear propulsion technology, which greatly limits their power projection capabilities. China and Russia, arguably America's two biggest geopolitical rivals at the moment, have but 4 aircraft carriers between them. Moreover, none of the other world's aircraft carriers can compete against the sheer size of the American carrier fleet either. America's aircraft carriers are divided right now between older Nimitz-class carriers that have been in service since 1975 and newer Gerald R. Ford-class carriers that have only begun entering into service since 2017, and which represent the largest warships that humanity has ever built. Each of America's 11 nuclear-powered carriers that are currently in service can carry more than 80 fixed-wing aircraft and helicopters on board, including dozens of modern F-35 fighter jets. meaning that a single one of America's carriers wields an air component that is more powerful than most countries' entire air forces are. Put all together, America's 11 carriers have enough aircraft between them to make them the 13th largest air force in the world by numbers alone, with more aircraft than are even in Britain's Royal Air Force that can be exported anywhere in the world. And because America's aircraft carriers are just so much bigger than the rest of the world's carriers are, the deck space on all 11 of them is literally more than double the deck space available of all the other aircraft carriers in the world combined. So far, the largest, most advanced, and capable aircraft carrier ever built outside of the United States is believed to be the Fujian, which was only launched by the Chinese People's Liberation Army Navy just a few months before I made this video in May of 2024. Nevertheless, the Fujian is still only powered by conventional diesel, which means that its range is severely limited and largely restricted to just operating near to the Chinese coast. And it can only store a complement of 50-plus aircraft on board compared to the 80-plus that can be stored on board American carriers. Even if the Fujian and every single other operating aircraft carrier in the world right now outside of the US Navy join forces to launch an all-out invasion of the US, they would A, almost all struggle to even get nearby to the US shores in the first place because all of them, besides the French carrier, would need oil and port refueling sites to keep them going. And there aren't too many friendly options for them around the US mainland. And B, they would only be capable of carrying around 560 aircraft split between fixed-wing craft and helicopters to the US shores, which is, frankly, pathetic compared to America's amphibious expeditionary capabilities that number nearly 900 aircraft across their carriers. And this is a big reason why even the entire outside world combined doesn't even have a fraction of the ability to project force around the world like the United States does, and why any potential invader of the US would struggle immensely with even transporting any meaningful air power to North America at all. And then, if the carriers weren't enough, there's also America's submarine fleet for any potential invader to consider as well. In addition to America's fleet of 14 strategic missile submarines that carry their nuclear weapons, the country has 50 advanced nuclear-powered attack submarines within its fleet as well, which are designed to stealthily seek out and destroy enemy submarines and surface vessels, and to project power with onboard Tomahawk cruise missiles and special operations forces. Numerically speaking, the rest of the world has significantly more submarines than the United States does, with Russia and China each having a similar number of total subs as America does, and the rest of the world having several dozen more. But, just like with America's fleet of advanced nuclear-powered aircraft carriers, all of America's submarines, including all of their attack subs, are powered by onboard nuclear reactors, while most of the rest of the world's submarines are still powered by diesel-electric propulsion. Nuclear-powered submarines are much, much more militarily advantageous than diesel subs are, because they're more independent and less reliant on ports since they don't need any fuel to keep themselves running for decades. They're also quieter, faster, and they can literally operate for months at a time continually underwater, while diesel-electric submarines can only remain submerged beneath the water for a few days at a time. They need to locate friendly ports to refuel themselves, their engines are louder and easier to detect, and they're slower. Meaning that nuclear-powered subs are just much better at remaining hidden and attacking enemies with surprise and traveling over longer distances. There's also only 5 other countries besides the United States that currently operate nuclear-powered submarines, with Russia having the most of them at only 31, less than half the total that the US operates, while China only has 12 of them. In fact, all of the other countries' nuclear submarine fleets combined only roughly match the number of nuclear submarines in the American fleet, while America's nuclear submarines are considered to be significantly more advanced, with the current acting commander of the US Pacific Fleet, Admiral Samuel Papero, stating that he believes American submarine technology is at least one entire generation, or about 10 to 20 years, ahead of rivals like Russia or China. So, while the US submarine fleet may be at a disadvantage against the entire rest of the world numerically, the US nuclear submarine fleet relies more on its significant technological superiority and their greater speed, stealth, endurance, mobility, and payload capacities than any rival submarine fleets are capable of. And that would be a significant hurdle for any potential invader composed of mostly diesel-electric submarines to ever overcome. So, with inferior submarines and inferior aircraft carriers, a potential invader of the United States, even if it was the rest of the world combined, would struggle immensely with projecting amphibious force to the shores of North America because of the U.S. Navy. And that's not even to mention the already tenuous supply chains that invading nations would have to run across thousands of miles of open ocean to maintain offensive operations in North America. We've already clearly seen the utterly disastrous logistics of the Russian army's invasion of Ukraine since 2022. And that's been a ground invasion into a neighboring country with thousands of miles of directly shared borders with direct rail connections, connecting it to Russia's factories, military bases, and supply centers. Imagine Russia, China, or even the rest of the world attempting to run logistics to support their invading army supply and ammunition needs across the vastness of the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, all while being harassed by dozens of stealthy American attack submarines. And even if they somehow were able to do all of that and get through the whole U.S. Navy, there's also the U.S. Air Force, which is also just amazingly more powerful and capable than any other global air force, bar none. It's often said in the U.S. military that the largest air force in the world is the U.S. Air Force, while the second largest is the U.S. Navy. The U.S. Air Force's budget alone is roughly the same as for the entire armed forces of China combined. While put together, the U.S. Air Force and the U.S. Navy alone possess nearly as many military aircraft as the next three largest countries do all combined: Russia, China, and India. Well, after you add in all of the other military aircraft in the rest of America's service branches, the full U.S. military controls more aircraft than the next five nations do combined, including South Korea and Japan, on top of India, China, and Russia. Currently, the U.S. military possesses around 630 super advanced F-35 fighter jets, which is about equivalent to all of the military aircraft combined in the entire United Kingdom. And that's just America's F-35s. And America's military plans to purchase about another 1,800 more F-35s too, which, when completed, will make America's F-35 fleet alone the world's fourth largest air force, with more F-35s than total aircraft in the entire Indian military combined. And remember that even with all of the aircraft carriers in the world right now outside of the U.S. Navy, the rest of the world combined could only really carry about 560 total aircraft to the shores near North America, which is fewer total aircraft than America has F-35 fighters. Not to even mention the thousands of other fighters like the F-16 and other aircraft in the U.S. military's arsenal that would obliterate all of that in an instant. So, in order to achieve aerial supremacy over the U.S. mainland, an invading army couldn't possibly rely on aircraft carriers to do so, and would have to rely on transporting huge numbers of aircraft to land-based bases around the U.S. instead. But unfortunately for any invader right now, virtually all of America's neighbors have mutual defense pacts with Washington and would never allow an invader to actually base their aircraft within their territory. Canada is a member of NATO, while the Bahamas, Haiti, the Dominican Republic, Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, Costa Rica, Panama, and Colombia are all members of the Rio Treaty, while Mexico maintains generally very friendly relations with the U.S. as well. The only nearby states with hostile relations to Washington are, arguably, Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela right now. And none of them have the infrastructure in place to support the huge amount of air power that would be necessary to actually challenge the U.S. Air Force and Navy for aerial supremacy. And even if every country around the United States was openly hostile to the country, it would require the transportation to North America of every single military aircraft located across Russia, China, India, South Korea, and Japan just to simply match the numbers of American military aircraft. And they would still have a significant technological and logistical disadvantage going up against the American aircraft. Okay, so we know that an amphibious invasion of the U.S. mainland is a practically impossible feat for anyone to accomplish. So let's imagine that, for some reason, every country around the United States has become deeply hostile to the country, and Canada, Mexico, the Bahamas, and Cuba all start allowing major outside powers from beyond North America to start piling up millions of troops and all of their supplies and equipment to prepare for an all-out ground invasion of the U.S. from across the Canadian and Mexican borders, with aerial support coming in from the Bahamas and Cuba and other air bases located across Canada and Mexico, with another shorter amphibious invasion punching into Alaska from across the Bering Strait from the Russian Far East into Alaska, just for good measure. Here's why none of that would ever still work out either. First of all, we need to discuss the idea of invading Alaska from across the Bering Strait. As it stands right now, Russia's most Far East territory, the Chukotka Autonomous Okrug, could never logistically support itself as a major staging ground for an invading army into Alaska. the entire population of this territory that's bigger than Texas is only a bit more than 50,000 people, making it one of the most sparsely populated places in the world that doesn't really have a lot of infrastructure. There are very few roads in the territory, and there aren't any railways or major ports at all, meaning that transporting and concentrating a large number of ground forces and all of their supplies here for an assault across the narrow Bering Strait into Alaska would be effectively impossible. Any possible assault into Alaska would have to be organized from much, much further away from Alaska in Russia's far eastern ports of Vladivostok and Nikotka, or from Japan, which presents the same logistical challenge as invading the US mainland would. The invading forces would have to establish reliable supply lines into Alaska stretching for thousands of miles across the northern Pacific, a difficult lesson that was learned the hard way by the Imperial Japanese during the Second World War. The last time in history that sovereign American territory was invaded and occupied by a hostile foreign power was between 1942 and 1943, when the Japanese occupied the small and sparsely populated Alaskan islands of Attu and Kiska, which they struggled to reinforce with supplies and were only able to hold on to for a year before getting overrun by much better supplied American and Canadian soldiers. Okay, but what about an invasion coming from the direction of Canada? Assuming that the Canadians were deeply hostile to the US for some reason and they started allowing millions of foreign soldiers into their territory for a big ground invasion across their border directly into the northern US. Unfortunately for the attacker, this direction too would be largely impossible to invade the United States from in any meaningful capacity for multiple reasons. First of all, there are significant geographic impediments to invading the US from the north. You have all five of the Great Lakes to consider stretching from Minnesota to New York that largely block an invasion coming from this direction penetrating into the industrial and population core of the Midwest, including rivers that separate close-by access points like Detroit and Buffalo from Ontario. And then you've also got the St. Lawrence Seaway that extends the rest of the way east from Lake Ontario through the rest of North America that empties out into the Gulf of St. Lawrence. That would be another challenging feature for an invading army to successfully cross over. And if these big lakes and rivers weren't enough of a defense, you also have the northern reaches of the rugged Appalachian Mountains that extend across northern New York, Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine, that an invading army would also have to somehow punch through next just in order to break into the heavily populated Northeast Corridor. Moreover, you've also got the presence of the huge Canadian Shield that extends across most of the entire country, a vast area of exposed rock and very thin topsoil, where agriculture is effectively impossible and where building infrastructure like highways or railways is extremely expensive and difficult. The largest town located anywhere on the Canadian Shield is Sudbury in Ontario, and it only has a population of 166,000 people, which means that concentrating large numbers of troops and equipment anywhere on the shield would be effectively an impossible task to do since the infrastructure to support one there just doesn't really exist. This leaves, hypothetically, the only geographically feasible invasion route from Canada into the United States in the far west of the country, from across the open fields of Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and Alberta down into the Great Plains across the center of the United States, or from British Columbia down into Washington State. But this option of an invasion route in the west of Canada would also struggle for so many reasons. First of all, there is very little to capture of strategic value for hundreds of miles away from the border here, with major American population centers all located very far away that would require a massive advance to actually capture. The distance from the border here to a major American city like Denver would be about the same distance as the German army had to advance from Warsaw to Moscow during the Second World War, and across even more challenging terrain. There are the hundreds of land-based ICBM silos located across here that an invading army could attempt and capture, but again, there's no way they could make it down to them in time before America would simply fire them. And then they'd have to advance for hundreds of miles across hostile terrain before reaching anything else important. And moreover, all along their advance, the invading army coming from this direction would encounter probably the strongest insurgency in the entire country, since the rates of gun ownership in the United States are high everywhere, but they are the absolute highest up here in the states of Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming, where more than 60% of the civilian population in all three of these states are reported to own firearms, and where the geography in western Montana, Wyoming, and all across Idaho is extremely mountainous and rugged. Meaning that any invading army coming from this direction would be effectively faced with an Afghanistan-style insurgency problem. And even worse from an invader's perspective here, because of how difficult it is to settle anywhere on the Canadian Shield and build any infrastructure across it, there's only one single highway that connects the two population cores of Canada to the east of the Shield and to the west of the Shield, the Trans-Canada Highway. And this problem is Canada's Achilles heel when it comes to potentially supporting an invasion into the United States. Because the Trans-Canada Highway converges in the city of Winnipeg in Manitoba. All the US military has to do in order to split Canada into two separate halves is to advance just far enough across their own border to seize and occupy Winnipeg, which would also leave Canada's core around Toronto, Ottawa, and Montreal incapable of logistically supporting the Western theater with any resupplies of troops, with the undeveloped Canadian Shield to the north and the US itself to the south. This single action by the US military would crush any invading army's ability to ever get supplies and logistics to an invasion force coming from this direction, with a massive US Air Force would just simply bombard the remaining length of the Trans-Canada Highway relentlessly that would eliminate any advancing columns of troops and armor rolling along it. In theory, even though the US capture of Winnipeg would eliminate the ability for the east of Canada to support the Western invasion, the invasion force could still possibly be supported by the port of Vancouver in the west in British Columbia. But that, too, would prove to be incredibly difficult to pull off from a geographic perspective. Vancouver is completely surrounded by the Cascade Mountains. And so, the only way to get troops, supplies, and equipment from Vancouver out to the invasion front in the east would be through the small number of highways and railways that snake through the narrow mountain passes of both the Cascades and then the Rockies too, towards the open fields in Alberta. Narrow mountain passes that would be relentlessly attacked and bombarded by the US Air Force and American missiles during an emergency that would shut them down from being usable. And even just getting hostile troops and equipment into Vancouver to begin with would be a challenging task in its own right. With the major US naval forces, including their nuclear submarines, located just to the south of Vancouver, within the protected waters of the Puget Sound that would disrupt any naval forces from even trying. Okay, so a ground invasion from Canada into the northern US is probably just about impossible, no matter how much international effort is put into it. So what about a ground invasion from Mexico into the southern US? This direction is, in theory, at least a little more plausible of a direction for an invading army to take than from Canada. But it would also, of course, still be incredibly challenging for a multitude of reasons. Most of the border in the center here is blocked by imposing geographic features like the southern Rocky Mountains and the vast, inhospitable, and sparsely populated deserts like the Mojave, Sonoran, and Chihuahuan that would all be very difficult for invading armies and their supply lines to advance across. Any big invading army coming from Mexico would therefore be left with little other choice than to either invade Southern California from Mexico's Baja California state, or into Southern Texas from the Mexican states of Tamaulipas, Nuevo León, or Coahuila. Unfortunately for any invader, however, both of these geographically more plausible invasion routes are heavily blocked by the two highest concentrations of American military personnel and equipment in the entire world. California has the highest concentration of US troops on the planet with 159,000 active duty soldiers based in the state as of 2022, while Texas isn't far behind with 113,000 active duty troops deployed to the state as well, which, when combined with Arizona and New Mexico, represent roughly 300,000 active duty US troops stationed nearby to the southern border. San Diego, immediately across the border from Mexico in the west, is a major concentration of the US military, with huge Navy and Marine Corps bases that alone is home to 115,000 active duty American soldiers, which blocks the narrow coastal approach into the rest of California with geographic features like the Mojave Desert and the Peninsular, Transverse, and Sierra Nevada mountains all heavily blocking the approach to the east of San Diego. And the situation in Texas wouldn't be much better, because the biggest US armor base in the entire world is located very near to the border here at Fort Cavazos, which alone is home to tens of thousands of American troops and hundreds of modern Abrams main battle tanks that could quickly organize a response to a ground invasion from this direction too. Moreover, the rest of the outside world combined would struggle with fielding enough tanks in North America to confront the massively lopsided advantage that the US military currently possesses in armor. The US military has around 61,000 tanks currently within its arsenal of war, which is more tanks than in the combined armies of the next three biggest tank forces in the world all combined: Russia, China, and Turkey. And Russia has recently lost thousands of their most advanced tanks in Ukraine since they invaded in 2022. So, all in all, the geographic defenses of the United States against an outside invasion are really unparalleled by just about any other country in the world. They have two massive oceans on either side of them to the east and the west. The Cascades, Sierra Nevada, and Rocky Mountains all in the west that dramatically impede an invasion from that direction, too. In addition to the Mojave, Sonoran, and Chihuahuan deserts, and to an extent the Rio Grande River, that would all impede invasions from the south. The Appalachian Mountains, the Great Lakes, the St. Lawrence Seaway, and the Canadian Shield, and its own sparse population across the Great Plains, that would all heavily impede an invasion coming in from the north. And even dense swamps in Louisiana and Florida that would slow down amphibious assaults coming up from the Gulf of Mexico, which all combine to roughly protect the core population centers of the United States from every single direction in an almost 360-degree sense. In short, the logistics required to transport untold numbers of soldiers and their equipment to the core population centers of the United States is really, really difficult to actually do. While at the same time, the logistics of transporting American soldiers and their equipment within the core of the country out to the frontiers where an invasion would be coming from is really, really easy to do. The continental U.S. is absolutely covered by nearly 50,000 miles of interstate highways that were designed, in part, for the easy and rapid facilitation of U.S. troop movements across the country. The U.S. has built out more roads across its country than any other country in the world ever has. And on top of the huge interstate highway system, there's also America's unrivaled freight railway system that can easily and quickly move troops and supplies around as well, which extends for around another 140,000 miles across the country's territory, and is the largest and densest network of freight railways that any country in the world has ever built. The United States, despite being a smaller country than Russia is in terms of land, has more than double the amount of railroads as Russia has, and more than 4.5 times as many roads as Russia has, enabling America's troops, supplies, and equipment to move around the country much more rapidly and easily than in Russia. And if all of that wasn't enough of an advantage during an invasion scenario, the U.S. also possesses the biggest network of navigable internal waterways in the entire world as well, with the Mississippi Basin, Snake and Columbia, Hudson, Intercoastal Waterway, and other navigable rivers, providing commercially navigable paths out to the ocean and throughout the country's interior to dozens and dozens of American cities and all of their factories, which would become another invaluable asset for the movement of American troops and supplies all throughout the country during an invasion scenario that couldn't possibly be blown up by conventional firepower. And if all of that still wasn't enough of an advantage, the U.S. could also implement the Defense Production Act during an invasion scenario as well, which would reconfigure civilian industrial production all across the country into military industrial production, with factories located all across the country that would be difficult for enemies to reach and destroy, but easy for the Americans to transport finished equipment from. As it currently stands, at least at the end of 2023, the U.S. military maintained an annual budget of $916 billion per year, which is already by far the highest military budget in the world. The U.S. alone already constitutes about 40% of worldwide military spending, and spends more on their military than the next 8 biggest spenders all do combined: China, Russia, India, Saudi Arabia, the UK, Germany, Ukraine, and France. And under an invasion scenario where the country is invoking the Defense Production Act, that budget would skyrocket even further. At the height of the Vietnam War in the late 1960s, America was spending more than 9% of its GDP on the military, nearly 3 times greater percentage-wise than it is currently. If the U.S. upped its military budget back to Vietnam War era levels again today, we'd be looking at an annual budget of more like $2.4 trillion a year, which is more than the entire combined economic output of major countries like Russia, Italy, or Brazil are capable of, which is just astonishingly insane. And even more advantageous, virtually all of the natural resources that the United States would need to actually defend itself with during an invasion scenario are also all located deep within the country's own interior. In terms of agricultural potential and food production, the U.S. controls arguably the most arable land of any country in the world, and indisputably controls the largest continuous piece of farmland in the world across the Mississippi Basin. The control of all this arable land across the interior of the country is why some people argue that the United States could easily support a population of more than 1 billion people like China or India do today with even less available farmland. But since America's population is only projected to maybe climb up to around 400 million by the end of the century, this won't ever happen, and the United States will always have the potential for huge food surpluses grown on their own territory. Which basically eliminates the ability for any country or even coalition of countries to ever blockade the United States and starve it out of food, even if they somehow destroyed the entire US Navy. Back in 2010, the Japanese Ministry of Agriculture, Forestry, and Fisheries compiled a list of countries they determined by food self-sufficiency rates on a calorie supply basis, and it only ranked 3 countries in the world as being completely self-reliant on calories for their own population: France, Australia, and of course the United States. With the US producing 24% more calories within their own borders than their population actually needs to survive. America's entire population and military could continue being well-fed no matter how bad the naval situation around the country's oceans got, while invading armies would have to bring all of their own food with them. And it's not just food production that the United States would be completely self-reliant on during an invasion scenario either. All of the country's most significant oil and gas fields outside of the offshore rigs on the Gulf of Mexico are located deep within the country's interior as well. And the United States currently uses all of these fields to produce about 75% of its own total oil supply and about 90% of its own total natural gas supply, with a vast network of pipelines running all across the country's territory that can quickly move fuel to exactly where it's needed. And of the 25% of America's oil supply that's currently imported, more than half of all of it simply comes in from Canada, while another 10% comes from Mexico across similar overland trade routes that are difficult for an enemy to block. This means that in addition to 75% of America's oil supply coming from within their own borders, another 15.5% all comes from Canada and Mexico, ultimately meaning that more than 90% of the US oil supply all comes from within the North American continent. Which means that a naval blockade of the United States cannot possibly disrupt the US military's fuel supply very substantially, nor the US economy's electricity supply, and nor could it disrupt America's food supply very substantially. Even if you somehow wiped out the entire country's Navy and Air Force and enemy soldiers were punching into the country's territory by land and by sea, the US could continue producing stuff out of all of its factories at virtually full capacity, and could continue running all of its vehicles without a major hit to its fuel supply. While the invaders would still be having to run unbelievably massive supply chains for their own fuel and supplies across the oceans and then through mountains and deserts on the continent. And if, somehow, if everything else fails, there is simply the massive and incredibly well-armed population within the United States for an invading army to be concerned about as well. The US government always maintains the Selective Service Program that operates an extensive database of all American men in the country aged 18 to 25. In the event of a huge national emergency, such as an invasion of the homeland, the Selective Service gives the country a pool of 15 million young military-aged men in the country that can be rapidly conscripted from and trained and equipped for war. With that in mind, it is generally thought that in order to overcome the inherent advantages of a defender during an invasion, the attacker should attack with at least a 3-to-1 advantage in manpower. Which implies that in order to have any realistic chance at overcoming the US military's manpower potential, an attacker would have to somehow cobble together a force of at least 45 million troops to invade the United States with. And they would somehow have to keep all of those troops well supplied across the world's oceans and motivated enough to continue fighting on a foreign continent, which is just a laughable prospect altogether. And even further, in order to combat against an insurgency after a hostile area has been occupied, the general rule of thumb in military circles is to leave behind a force of at least 40 soldiers for every 1 civilian in an occupied area, which is similar to the ratio that the Americans used in occupied Germany after World War II and the NATO forces used in Kosovo after occupying it in 1999. Since the total US population is currently around 336 million people, this would imply that even if a hostile force was somehow miraculously capable of conquering the entire country, they would have to leave behind a force of at least 8.4 million soldiers all across the country just to have any hope of quelling the insurgency of America's population, which is alone more than twice as many soldiers as Germany invaded the Soviet Union with in 1941. and the insurgency that would erupt all across the United States would probably be even worse than anything else in the world ever has been. Because no other civilian population in all of human history has ever been as well armed as the American population is. It's been estimated before that a whopping 46% of all the firearms in the entire world are currently owned by Americans. Around 393 million firearms, both legal and illegal, are believed to be in the possession of American civilians right now, which is millions more guns than the country's total population is. This is also why it's estimated that there's roughly 120 firearms in civilian ownership in the United States for every 100 residents, and why there are more firearms in the hands of American civilians than in the next 24 countries with the highest rates of gun ownership all combined. And there are literally millions of these American gun owners who have fantasized about this exact invasion scenario taking place every single day, who would immediately take to the hills and the mountains and become the deadliest partisans ever seen in human history. So ultimately, for many, many, many reasons, an invasion of the US mainland is just not really a feasible possibility, no matter how powerful an invading force might be. There's simply far too many obstacles standing in the way between an invading army and success. But that doesn't mean that the US cannot be hurt or have its interests disrupted in other ways. The US mainland can, obviously, still become the subject of major attacks from hostile foreign powers, if not outright invasions. And the biggest and worst attack that ever befell the US on its own territory happened recently, only 23 years ago, on September 11th, 2001. Osama bin Laden and his Al-Qaeda organization, the perpetrators of the deadliest attack in American history that killed nearly 3,000 Americans, would later claim that their strategy for carrying out the attack on American soil was to goad the United States and its allies into a costly war of pursuit against them all across the world. And over the next two decades following the attacks, the United States would indeed wage a global war in response across seven Muslim-majority countries from Afghanistan and Iraq to Pakistan, Somalia, Libya, Yemen, and Syria in their so-called global war on terror that would end up costing the United States at least $6 trillion worth of treasure and more than 7,000 American soldiers' lives and blood. An unprecedented global manhunt was launched across the entire world for years that relentlessly pursued Osama bin Laden and his accomplices who were responsible for carrying out the attack, that unquestionably demonstrated America's willingness to go to the ends of the earth and pursue all available means, no matter how ethically questionable, to pursue all those responsible who had dared to attack the American homeland. The global war on terror and the manhunt for Osama bin Laden and other Al-Qaeda officers would span multiple presidential administrations and last for years until bin Laden was finally tracked down to a secluded compound in Pakistan in 2011 and eliminated during a daring cross-country special forces raid. The course of events that led up to the 9/11 attacks themselves, and then to the entire manhunt for bin Laden that led up to the raid on him a decade later in 2011, and the decades-long ramifications of America's global war on terror for both the United States itself and for the entire rest of the world is what makes it all perhaps the single most important of all 21st century conflicts to really understand. Because it explains so much about why our current world looks and functions the way it does. But unfortunately, if I made a really in-depth video about how Al-Qaeda planned out its own logistics for the attack, and then how the global manhunt for Osama bin Laden and the other Al-Qaeda leaders responsible went, and how America pursued its global war on terror, the many disturbing, violent, and controversial details of discussing what's still a very recent and horrible conflict and tragedy would cause the whole video to become demonetized and age-restricted, which I completely understand and believe is actually appropriate. But it also ultimately means that YouTube's algorithm would never promote any of the video to you, and there's just simply no way that you'd ever see it here. And that's why instead, I created yet another full-length companion video to this one in my ongoing Modern Conflict series that's about the same length as this video that covers the entire course and explanation into how Al-Qaeda was able to attack the United States so successfully on September 11th without getting detected first, and then how the US intelligence community hunted for Osama bin Laden all across the ends of the earth, and eventually found him a decade later in Pakistan. And I uploaded it directly to Nebula, which, as I'm sure you've already heard by now, is home to tons of exclusive, ad-free content like my entire Modern Conflict series, with more than 30 other full-length exclusive videos over there that you can go and watch right now covering dozens of recent major wars and conflicts that'll all help you stay up to date on what's going on in our world and why. From this video covering the entire history of the U.S. Al-Qaeda conflict that happened before 9/11, these ones covering the U.S. invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq in more detail, these ones covering the International Coalition's war against ISIS in Iraq and Syria, all of these ones covering the ongoing Russian invasion of Ukraine, and many, many more with brand new episodes releasing every single month. And even better, I also recently started another completely new monthly video series on Nebula called War Room, which will track all of the latest breaking geopolitical news developing from conflicts around the world and break them down into a single, easily digestible monthly video briefing series that'll help you stay even more up to date and informed on what's currently happening around the world and why. The latest episode in War Room, covering all of the breaking geopolitical news and developments from last month in July, is already live on Nebula for you to go and watch right now. And new episodes in War Room will be released every month, just like the monthly new episodes in Modern Conflicts have been, meaning two new exclusive real-life lore videos on Nebula that you won't find on YouTube going out every month going forward. And what's even more, you also get access to all of the other amazing exclusive content that's on Nebula, because the best part about this site is that it's jointly co-owned by all of its hundreds of creators, built by myself and hundreds of other independent YouTubers and podcasters. And because it's a subscription-based service, we all get to work on way bigger and higher budget productions over there than we could ever afford to do on our own on YouTube. That's why there's tons of other exclusive content that you'll find equally fascinating from all of these other creators over there that you probably also already know as well. And right now, Nebula is also selling lifetime memberships that'll last for as long as both you and Nebula exist. Lifetime memberships cost $300 and they'll last you forever. There's no tricks or gimmicks, you just pay once and you'll have access to everything that will ever exist on Nebula forever. That way, you can avoid paying a recurring monthly subscription, and the capital we're raising from lifetime subscriptions are being all reinvested into even more new content on the site to expand our even more ambitious projects of movies, plays, shows, and documentaries that are all still soon to come, and that I'm very excited about. And best of all, if you'd rather sign up for an annual or monthly plan to Nebula, that's fine too. And you can sign up for one by clicking the button that's here on your screen right now, or by following the link down below in the description, or by scanning the QR code here on your screen, any of which will give you an insanely good 40% discount off of an annual subscription. It's the absolute best way to help support what I'm doing here on Real Life Lore. And as always, thank you so much for watching.